going to be an engineer. Don't worry. You hear me? It's on, right? So where's the on switch to the projector? No remote control for the projector. Maybe someone has to climb up and press a button. It's the first time I'm in this room, so I hope we'll be more smooth next time. Let's see if we get a picture. Maybe this is if we switch off some of the lights. Okay. Is it okay? You can see okay, and you hear me in the back of the room? Okay, welcome. So happy to see so many students today. How many of you are bachelor students? Master students? None, okay. I thought there were some master students as well. So this is a combined subject, security planning and incident management. It's both a master and bachelor subjects. And my name is Marie Mo. I'm going to be your teacher this semester. This is the fourth time I'm giving this subject. And unfortunately, it's also the last time because of the new study programs. But this subject is going to be a part of master subject two that I will start teaching in the fall. So I'm not quitting as a teacher at Gjøvik. Because I really like to teach and I feel really inspired by helping students and maybe inspiring you to a career in incident response. So how many of you know what incident response and incident management is? Just a little bit, okay? But you do know why we need to plan for incidents? Yes. That's sort of the motivational part I'm going to use the first two lectures today talking about. I'm going to say a little bit more about myself. Just one slide. This is not a lecture about myself. But then I'm going to use the next 2 hours lecturing you about what could possibly go wrong. Just a long string of examples of what goes wrong and why the world is such a scary place to be in right now, just to scare you a little bit more. Maybe you heard about some of these things before, but I'm going to also give you some more background information because I've been working with some of these incidents before. But then I want to activate you. I don't want to do this teaching as a one-way thing. I want to try to engage you as good as I can. So you're going to play a little game. after the break. So there's a break, a lunch break between 11 and 12. And then we reconvene in another room, which is the K105. And unfortunately, for those of you watching the stream, when I tried to put up the live streaming yesterday, there were some technical difficulties with the room K105. There were no sound from that room, so I couldn't schedule a recording. So unfortunately, the next the last 2 hours of today won't be on the tape or won't be recorded. So that's a shame. But most of the things that I'm going to go through after the break will be interactive with the class. So we'll have this 4Cs game, and then I'm going to do a little bit more lectures, which you can read yourself in the book if you miss it. And then we're going to, that lecture will be about risk management and contingency planning. And then we're going to end the day with a quiz, a Kahoot quiz. And I might pick up a prize in the break for you, for the person that wins the quiz. So I hope it's going to be fun. So first, about me. So I'm a research scientist at SINTEF, which is in Trondheim. So my day job is in Trondheim, which means I'm only here in Gjøvik to give these lectures. But of course, you can reach me through email if you have questions. And I'm also going to have a student assistant helping me with this course, doing some of the project work guidance for you. So this position at NTNU Gjøvik is 20% of my time. And then I also work at the work with doing actual security research at SINTEF. My background is a master's degree in mathematics from NTNU with a specialization in cryptography. And then I went on to do a PhD in information security at the telematics department, which has now actually been merged with you in Gjøvik in a new department after the merging. I've been working in the industry for some years. I worked a couple of years doing R&D at a private company in Trondheim. And then I also was involved in some security-related projects and also some standardization work. But then I started a job at the NorCERT, at the National Security Authority in Norway, doing incident handling. And I worked there for 4 years. And that's mainly the experience that I'm bringing into this teaching. So I'm teaching about incident response, and I have actually hands-on experience with doing incident response. And I was also, for a couple of years, team leader at the NorCERT Operations Center, where you can see this picture, where we have all these fancy screens showing what's going on around Norway, cyber attacks, and where we were working closely with the victims of cyber intrusions and helping them with their incident management and incident response. And since 1.5 years ago, I quit my job in NorCERT because I wanted to move back to Trondheim. And I started as a research scientist. And these are my contact details. So please, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I do tweet a lot about like things that can be relevant for your students. So I encourage you to follow me. Also, you can add me on LinkedIn if you want to. And I'm also on Skype. So it's possible also for you students that are not here at Gjøvik, but is following this subject remotely, to schedule a Skype call if it's needed. Any questions about me? No?
How many Twitter followers do you have that are students?
I don't know how many of them are students, but I do have 2,000 and something Twitter followers. And the last, let's say, one year, or last year, I've been doing a lot of talks about one of my projects, which is hacking medical devices. I also have a medical device myself. I have a pacemaker implant. And I'm started to investigate the security of these devices. So that's something I tweet a lot about if you're interested in medical device security. I'm not going to go through that in this lecture. But if you have some questions, please feel free to ask them. Okay, enough about me. So, what could go wrong? Why do we need to prepare for managing incidents? Imagine that you are you finished your studies here at Gjøvik, and you got your first job, and your job is to keep the networks of companies secure. So, what should you be prepared for? What can happen? There's a lot of things that can happen. Of course, hacking or cyber is a big thing. So, I want to start with saying a little bit about my conception about cyber. Cyber is many things, and it's become like a buzzword the last few years. We used to call it InfoSec before, but now it seems like cyber is the word that everyone wants to use. And it's sort of a bit diffuse what this means, and depending on who you're talking to, this can be a lot of things. So it can be like script kiddies doing things on the net, DDoSing their friends because they want to kick them off their online gaming or something like that. Hacktivism, we've seen a lot of that last 4 or 5 years. Here it's illustrated by a guy wearing an anonymous Guy Fawkes mask. It's a pretty interesting story behind that picture. I don't know if I'm going to go into the details, but this was a picture that I found on Twitter, actually. He and a friend, they are posing in front of the North Shirt. I don't know if you can see it, but there's a sign saying North Shirt behind them. And they were sort of teasing North Shirt about their hacktivism. And I was giving a presentation for some guys working at the police in Norway. This was a couple of years after I found this picture on Twitter. And they said, we've seen the original picture of that one. So, yeah. Maybe not going to go into all the details of that case. But we do have financial crime as the kind of biggest number of cyber incidents. That's where we see the big volume, because there are money to be made, and of course this attracts criminals. So that's why we're worried about the companies getting hacked, losing our credit card details and so on, being hit by ransomware. It's a lot of money to be made if you're a criminal in this area. But then we can also think of cyber as more things going on between nation states and also industrial espionage, like nations are helping their own industry by stealing trade secrets and intellectual property. Also, you can have cases of sabotage, not so many documented cases of that yet. But it's something that you should be worried about, at least when it's related to crisis or war-like situations. So on the left side here, we have the more chaotic actors. The tracked actors are a bit harder to describe. Then we move on to the more criminal threat actors and the advanced persistent threats. Have you heard about that before? APT. Someone's nodding. Who's heard about APT? It's also something that the media liked to use a couple of years ago a lot, usually describing Chinese cyber espionage campaigns. So these are well-resourced adversaries that have people working 8 to 4 or 9 to 5 attacking, doing cyber offensive cyber operations to get hold of secrets, get hold of information, or maybe in a kind of information operations or computer network operations where you try to get into other nations, other industrial companies' networks and get hold of their secrets, or maybe spread disinformation, like disinformation campaigns. And all of these are really not being talked about a lot until the last 4 or 5 years started to become. First, we had some news reports about Chinese hacking, and then now lately it's a lot about Russian hacking. And of course, this has been something that has been discussed or been a big issue in the military and the intelligence agencies for a long time, but it's not been openly shared information about this. But we see a change in this. It's becoming a bit more mainstream and a lot more talk about these threats. So it means that things that previously were going on that we didn't know about is now coming out in the light. So we know about it. So this is my sort of attempt to describe cyber in one slide. Any questions on cyber? What's cyber? Still a bit unclear, maybe? Yeah. But anyway, this is what we're the world we're living in today and all the threats that we are facing. So I'm going to go through some examples from the real world examples. And I'm going to start in this corner and then sort of move up to more and more serious things. But of course, it all depends on your perspective. Someone DDoSing a site can be really serious for the company that's hit by this. They can lose a lot of money. So even script kiddies or people with little technical expertise and small resources can do a lot of damage in this area. So I'm going to go some years back in time for my first example. Anyone remember this? Operation Quisling is an example of one of the first kind of anonymous campaigns that were out in the media and that affected Norway. So this was the in April 2011. The political parties in Norway were targeted by hacktivists because of the data retention proposal of a new law that would collect a lot of information from citizens, and people didn't like this, datalagringsdirektivet. So some hacktivists started a campaign to DDoS the political parties in Norway. And this is one of their sort of call to actions. Sorry about potential swear words in some of these slides. I'm sure you can cope with that. So I had just started working for NorCERT when this happened. So I remember this sort of from the other side of handling these incidents. So they actually managed to disrupt a meeting that Arbeiderpartiet was holding by DDoSing their websites. And the way they did this was by just telling kids or people around that were supporting the cause to download the tool and start just put in the IP address of the website and start DDoSing. And of course, a lot of kids that were involved in this, they didn't really know how this worked, and they had an IRC channel where they were trying to coordinate their efforts. And it was kind of funny because in that IRC channel, I think there were more people monitoring what was going on in the IRC channels than the actual kids doing the attacks. So it was pretty easy to figure out what was going on and who was participating in this. But they managed actually to get some attention and to create some havoc by doing this. There are other examples also of teenagers participating in doing DDoS attacks against Norwegian interests or Norwegian firms. And also, several of these got police could easily find them because they didn't really have the technical skills to hide themselves that good. And they had actually they got prosecuted and convicted for their crimes. But since these were kids, usually they didn't get that strict sentences. But these are the sort of the first examples of cyber attacks that got convicted in where people got convicted in Norway. I think they got they had to actually pay 50,000 kroners because of this DDoS attacks. So it's for a teenager, that's quite a lot of money. So I urge you to not do these things if it's not clear already. Also, this case, there was a 17-year-old that was posing as a larger group from Anonymous, and he managed to actually get the websites of several banks in Norway to shut down because of the DDoS attacks. He was also pretty bad at his OPSEC, or operational security, so it was pretty easy for the law enforcement to find him. And he had to serve 150 hours doing community service for his crimes. But originally, he was facing the possibility of having to pay 400,000 Norwegian kroners because of the consequences of the DDoS attacks. And these were calculated by the different companies that were hit, and they looked into how many hours they used to clean up this mess and how much money they lost because their websites were down. So so this is something that one person managed to do, like from his own computer. So what he did, like technically, was actually something called a pingback WordPress attack. So he managed to find around the world a lot of WordPress sites that had a configuration, configuration error or a setting that allowed for whenever you mention someone on your WordPress blog, there's a feature that can make this blog ping back to the blog that is mentioned. So what you can do is actually craft messages where you pretend to mention a lot of blogs, and all these blogs will then start DDoSing the site that you are directing these requests to. And the underlying problem with a lot of DDoS attacks is that you can spoof your IP address, and you have protocols that do not authenticate the origin of packets. So it's possible to redirect packets as you choose. Or reflection attacks means that you can reflect packets on the web and tell them to go to somewhere where they're not supposed to go. This is one of the underlying problems that's causing DDoS attacks. And maybe some of you remember this. This is 1 year ago. Over the holidays, Christmas holidays, a lot of people couldn't access or couldn't use their Sony PlayStations because of this DDoS attack. So it actually created a lot of fuss. Because people got their Christmas present, unwrapped theirs on the PlayStation, and then couldn't use it because of this. And this points to another problem that we've seen a lot of the last year. Devices on the internet that can be, because of default credentials, because of bad configuration, or just because of bad devices, they can be utilized in so-called reflected DDoS attacks. So in this case, there was something called a lizard stressor. Stressor is what you can buy DDoS services on the web. So actually, the skills needed to do to perform a DDoS attack is just to have a credit card in most cases. So these services, they call themselves stressors because they claim to the business ID is to stress your own server and see how much traffic it tolerates. But then, of course, you can point this to any server you want to. So then you can actually use it as a tool to attacking others. And in this case, there were some home routers, home access points devices that had this bad default configuration that allowed them to become zombies in this sort of DDoS attack. Okay, so how do we get hacked? There are so many ways that you can get hacked. And these are some of the popular ones. I don't know if you recognize or can relate these to different types of incidents. So we have things like the Internet Explorer. It's become a bit notorious because it has had a lot of security vulnerabilities that could be exploited. But this is some years ago. But then Office Word, enable macros is a very common way of getting someone to social engineer the victim to opening documents and then allowing things to be executed on their computer. Java, same thing, has had a lot of vulnerabilities that and also 0 days that could be exploited. And PDF documents. So typically these are things that come as attachment to emails. This is a very popular infection vector, sending emails to your victim, phishing emails or spear phishing emails that are more targeted. You can also send emails without any malicious attachment and still social engineer people. Have you heard about whaling or CEO fraud? That means sending emails to the CEO or pretending to come from the CEO to someone that is in charge of financials in a company and trick them into sending money somewhere. So if you get instructions from your boss, of course, usually people just perform those instructions. And then you have like installations on servers that have had bad default configurations or also security vulnerabilities that have been exploited. A couple of years ago, we had this someone called a Drupalgeddon or something. There was a vulnerability discovered that if you didn't patch your Drupal installation within 7 hours or something, you would most likely already have been hacked because there were scripts that automatically scanned the internet for vulnerable installations. And there was a new vulnerability. And of course, people usually don't patch within 7 hours. It usually takes a little bit more time than that. So we had lots and lots of Drupal installations that were taken over. JBoss, open source framework that's been actually a reason that a lot of hospitals had to shut down or had to respond to the problem of ransomware the last year. They got ransomware in the systems. They had to turn patients away because they couldn't access their IT systems, and they needed this to be able to treat patients. And turns out that in many cases they had unpatched JBoss instances that allowed this ransomware to spread. WordPress, I already mentioned. What's often the case is that someone has made a website and then they just forget about it. And sometimes even big companies that you would assume have everything in order can have some of these like web service running that maybe there was a project, someone abandoned this project, and then this can be used as an entrance point to their network and they can be hacked. This happened to one of the biggest media houses in Norway, actually. OpenX is a framework for ads that are shown on web pages. And malicious ads is also one vector that can be used for drive-by attacks. Means that if you just surf into a website, you don't have to click anything, you can get hacked or infected, because it's malicious ads being served. And the way ads are displayed is really complex. And sometimes you can't actually figure out who put the ad in there because of this, the way that ads work. So there are cases where criminals have legitimately bought ad spaces. They haven't hacked anything, but then they put in malicious ads. And that's the way they infect people. And of course, you remember this logo, Heartbleed. You can have this really dangerous, or this really hazardous 0 days that creates a lot of problems and gets a lot of attention. And this was actually the first time a bug got its own logo. And after this, this has become kind of a trend. But it's open. SSL has had some more scrutiny, I would say, after this original Heartbleed bug, and we see more problems also in this frameworks. Okay, I think I'm going through all of them. What do you think is the most dangerous or the most likely way you get hacked? What's the biggest threat? No one wants to make a guess?
Well, I'm looking at social engineering attacks with an email system. It's almost like that, because they have mail.
Yeah, that's in the most, the more, say, advanced or dangerous intrusions, there's usually this mouse that's the problem. Someone's clicking on things. So you have all these vulnerabilities, you have more. I put some of this here that I wanted to sort of name and shame, but there are bugs in all written code, and there are people that are looking for ways of exploiting your systems, but usually they have to do some human factor or social engineering human to get into systems. Not always, but that's often the case. And then you don't need to have any vulnerabilities at all. You can just social engineer your way into networks. What's important is there's always someone behind the attack. So you shouldn't think about bugs and vulnerabilities as the threat. The threat is the person, the threat actor, that has intentions, that has target, that has reasons to target you and wants to attack you. And that's something you need to think about when you're doing your threat analysis and risk assessment. What's of interest in your network? What are the crown jewels? What do you want to protect? What is the critical information that someone would be want to get to? And how big a target are you? Who is targeting your interests? And of course, this will vary depending on your company and your person. And even though your systems are not connected to the internet, there's still a possibility of getting hacked. For instance, by USB sticks, or by contractors coming in and plugging into your systems. That's how critical infrastructure and control systems can be hacked, even if they're not connected to the internet. Okay, any questions? How do you get hacked? You want more examples? I have plenty of them. So this one, just continuing on the DDoS thing. DDoS attack on DIN. Anyone of you remember that? Just a couple of months ago, it was in October last year. It affected a lot of US networks, and that means it affected, for instance, Twitter. Twitter was down. It affected Amazon, Spotify, Netflix. Maybe some of you remember you couldn't log into Netflix for a while. So this created a lot of problems. Because DIN is a service provider of DNS services and also being used by these big companies. And what caused this until now biggest or largest DDoS attack? Someone said it was in the order of a terabyte of data. Was actually Internet of Things. It was mainly consisting of traffic coming from surveillance cameras that were produced by a Chinese manufacturer, and these cameras had default credentials. And there's a botnet called the Mirai botnet that was behind a lot of this. Well, the botnet wasn't behind, someone was behind the attack, but the botnet was used in the attack. And the Mirai botnet works the way that it constantly you have scanning for these Internet of Things devices that have have default credentials, so you know the password and the username to log into these things. Once they find one of these things on the internet, the script also gets installed on this device, and this device joins the botnet and starts looking for more unsecure devices to add to the botnet. So all this traffic came from all these devices that are connected to the internet and that can be easily logged into. And the problem is when you have this Internet of Things that comes with default credentials that are actually hard-coded into the devices, it's kind of hard to remediate. So this is an ongoing problem. We still haven't solved this. Still we have the potential of all this devices attacking others, so it's a problem for defenders like us. Like, you're going to become a defender and maybe an incident responder. You have to figure out how to deal with this. Thanks. Anyone of you got any ideas of how it's possible to fight these things? It's kind of a complex problem. No? There's ongoing work actually in the background all the time that CERTS, Computer Emergency Response Teams, are part of, in trying to clean up the internet. So cleaning the internet of bad things, bad configurations, bad devices that shouldn't be on the internet, and so on. Whenever there's a DDoS attack, what happens usually is that you have somewhere someone can collect logs containing IP addresses of all the things that are participating in the DDoS attack. It's often a problem if this is, for instance, UDP traffic, where you can have spoofed IP addresses. You can't really figure out where it came from. But if you have TCP traffic, you can find the the IP addresses. You can actually have a list of what types of devices or what devices were participating in the DDoS attack. So the defenders have a list of IP addresses, but how do they reach out to the owner of these things and make them change the configuration? That's a kind of complex part. So that's something I learned while working at the CERT, how we did this or tried to do this. There's intelligence, threat intelligence sharing, and there's also sharing of infected devices between the defenders. So what they typically can do is to take all this list of hundreds of thousands of IP addresses, split them up into countries by geolocation on the IP addresses, and then send this list to each country's national CERT team, and then ask them to contact the internet service providers, and then the internet service providers can contact their customers and ask them to get their device off the internet. Or make the or change the password. So as you see, it's not easy. It's something that is try to do, but often you don't get through to the sort of all the way through, and you can't clean up everything. So it's work in progress. So Internet of Things is kind of scary. Everything is sort of being connected to the internet, and there are you've probably seen graphs like this before. It's kind of exploding problem, but this is I think is something that's really scary. Can you see something special about this teddy bear? You seen this before? If you look at this. Its nose is actually a camera inside of the teddy bear. So this is a toy that can turn into a surveillance device in case it gets hacked and is in kids' bedroom all over the world. You have already problems with baby monitors that have default credentials and that are just streaming photos on the internet from children's bedrooms. It's kind of not okay in my mind. In this case, this teddy bear was looked into a bit closer by some researchers, some white hat researchers, and they found out that it has some web service API calls that were not authenticated. It meant that someone or anyone who found this bug could get into the just make calls to the database and get list of child's names, date of births, and genders and what language they spoke, which is kind of scary. What would have been even more scary was, of course, if they could turn on the camera and make this and actually look into the bedroom of the child. But that was not the case in this toy that was connected. If you want to read more about these different examples, I put in source URLs on most of them, so you can have a closer look into the technical details. Hello Barbie, anyone seen this before? It's a Barbie, but it's also containing electronics, and it's part of the Internet of Things. And it talks to servers, it has an accompanying app. So smart toys, they're kind of scary. Also in this case, researchers found some vulnerabilities. There were 14 vulnerabilities in the Toy Talks web servers and could have been scary because it turns out that this Hello Barbie doll, it records conversations in the room and uploads them to the cloud. It was encrypted files in this case, which is good. This is a worst case. WeTech had a play camera that lots of like 200,000 kids had registered into their database, and the hacker was actually managed to retrieve all this information from VTech. They found names, email addresses, passwords, home addresses, and names, birthdays, and even pictures of kids in this case. And also this server contained recorded audio files that were not encrypted. So if you look into this, there's a really scary audio file that's actually an example of what this hacker found. That has been recorded by the toy in the home of the kids. So scary stuff, and really bad for privacy. I also have some newer, more updated things. So this happened over the last few weeks. Lots of MongoDB instances were hacked and used in a Bitcoin ransomware scheme. So what happened was that all the content in these databases was erased by the hackers, the hacker. And there was a ransom note put in instead, which says, send 0.2 Bitcoins to this address to recover your database. So this is also illustrating the problem with things that are unsecured on the internet, where anyone without any authentication can log in because of this default configuration problem. Okay, I'm going to give you a break now for 15 minutes, and then we continue the long row of scary examples. So see you in 15 minutes.
Okay, welcome back. You hear me okay back there? Yeah? We're starting again? So, ransomware. And have you been hit by ransomware? No? You haven't seen anything like this on your computer? This is a kind of earlier version of ransomware where a computer gets locked and you can't get past this screen unless you know how to remediate it. Sometimes the ransomware actually encrypts things and sometimes it doesn't encrypt things, it just claims to encrypt. So in some cases it's possible to bypass it or recover your files, but in other cases it's kind of game over. You need to have a backup of your files unless you actually pay the criminals and hope that they do as they said. Usually you can't trust the criminals to actually give you your files back, so I never encourage anyone to pay ransom. This is a type of ransomware that came after the NSA revelation and the Snowden things going on. So it was sort of nasty because, I don't know if you see this, this thing, illegal content found. So what happened in this type of ransomware was that it claimed that your computer has been used for illegal downloading illegal stuff, but it actually also placed illegal stuff on your computer, which is kind of nasty. And here is some of the illegal content that was kind of uncomfortable for the viewer to see because it's child abuse material. So you can get different types of ransomware, and of course there's money to be made because you use a scare tactic to scare people into paying. And as I already mentioned, last year hospitals all over the world have been hit by ransomware, this kind of nasty thing. And actually there are several documented cases where they admitted to have paid the ransom in bitcoins because they really needed access to the files, and probably they didn't have good enough backup solutions. So back to this case that we saw recently, the last few weeks of the MongoDB database problems. Anyone of you know about John Natterly? Who he is? No? Okay. You know Shodan? Search engine for finding things on the internet? Okay, so John Natterly is the man that created Shodan, and he also is keeping an eye on whatever is on on the internet that maybe shouldn't be there. And he actually wrote a blog post in 2015 about this problem of MongoDB instances that could be logged into without any authentication or with default installations. And he has been keeping an eye on this and track this, and I think this was last week. He has been scanning the internet, the whole internet, for MongoDB instances and how much content is on them. And he found that this ransomware actually erases the content on the database. So you can see here 364 terabytes of content in these databases, and then 5 days later, 258 terabytes. So it's a lot of data that was deleted in 5 days by these hackers. So originally there was one hacker that was behind this, and then we have some kind of copycats that... so now we have several hackers doing this. And here's from the Shodan search engine. You can see how many exposed MongoDB instances there are around the world and which countries you can find them in. So it's just out there and it's really vulnerable. So John has pinged the internet. That's what he's doing, and that's what the Shodan search engine is doing. It's just constantly searching for things that are possible to find on the internet, grabbing banners so that you can search for things that are running on different port numbers, for instance. And this is a map of everything that is responding if you try to ping it on the internet. And maybe you remember this from a couple of years ago. There was some reporters at Dagblad that investigated the state of the internet in Norway and things that can be found exposed on the internet. And they found a lot of things that shouldn't be on the internet in Norway. They found critical infrastructure systems. They found plans for emergencies at a chemical plant with pictures of all the different things that were in the plant and the factory and so on. And they found lots of exposed surveillance cameras that were just streaming pictures to the internet that the owners weren't aware of, and they found a lot of like FTP servers without any authentications where you could just browse the files of internal files from the company and so on. And what the journalist did was to reach out to some of these victims and tell them about their problems. And they also reached out to NSM and NorCert, where I was working at the time, and gave us lists of IP addresses of exposed equipment that was on the internet or critical infrastructure systems in Norway, so that we could then again contact the system owners. This was not the first time that this happened. It's actually when I was working my first year in NorCert, we got the first report ever of exposed critical infrastructure systems or control systems, process control systems running on Norwegian IP addresses. And we got this via the US CERT. And there was a researcher that had scanned the whole internet and found these devices as part of his master thesis, actually. And he handed this information over to the US CERT, and they then again distributed this list of IP addresses to the different national CERTs so that we could contact system owners. And that was back in 2011. So I wanted to show you a video, but might have a problem with the sound because I couldn't hook up my computer to the sound. But I'll try to play this as loud as I can on my computer, so maybe you can hear it. It's both in Norwegian and English, so sorry for you that don't understand Norwegian. But some of it is in English too, and it's about this incident where they found a lot of things that shouldn't be on the internet. And you also see the researcher, Aaron Leverett, is also interviewed here, and he was the one that originally, for the first time when I worked at the CERT, sent us this list through the US CERT. And I've since become friends with him, and we're actually now hacking together on the medical devices. It's kind of funny.
Sannsynligvis ikke møtt John Matherly før. mannen bak sökemotorn Shodan gör inte många offentliga uppträdanden. Här håller han ett sjeldent föredrag I den schweiziska byn Luzern om hur Shodan kan brukas till att söka på allt som är kopplat på nät.
Shodan is a search engine that lets you find anything that's connected to the internet, meaning, you know, your iPhone, your webcam, your laptop. If you connect to the internet, Shodan can find it.
Overvåkningskameror, usikrede dataserverer, avanserte kontrollsystemer, printere. Allt blir kartlagt av sökemotorn som av många blir kallt världens farligaste sökemotor.
What if bad guys use Shodan? And my answer to that is, they have been using similar tools for more than a decade. They can use similar tools right now.
Google söker på nettsidor. Shodan söker efter enheter kopplat till nät och visar därmed en ny sida av internet.
Because it highlights a part of the internet. Most people had the idea that if it's not on Google, it's not on the internet. Almost everybody uses Google and they find websites that way. But Shodan provides a very different window or different view of the same internet. In a way, Google is one filter on the internet and Shodan is the raw, unfiltered version of the internet.
Dagbladet har I lenge tid brukt Shodan til å søke etter sikkerhetshull I Norge. Genom serien Null Kontroll har vi presenterat funnene våre, som bland annat bestod av 2048 usikrede övervakningskameror, 600 printere, kopimaskiner och skannere som låg öppet utan krav till passord. Vi öppna dataserverer och sensitiv information har ligget öppet för alla som vill se. Alla säkerhetshullen som Dagbladet fant är meldt fra till ejer, nettleverandør eller nationella säkerhetsmyndigheter. NSM har sitt hovedkvarter I Oslo og overvåker kritiske datainstallasjoner I samfunnet. Fra kontrollrommet tar de opp kampen med hackerne. Niklas Wilhelm kjenner godt til Shodan og vet at mange skeptiske til søkemotoren.
Den del som har vært litt skeptiske til Shodan når det kom, fordi de har ment at det kan bli brukes av hacker, det gjør det veldig mye lettere for en hacker å få oversikt til systemet, selv hvis de ikke selv kyndige. Og de tenker at det øker eksponeringen, at det øker farene. Jeg ikke enig I den vurderingen, fordi med Shodan så ble det økt oppmerksomhet på sårbarheter, og da særlig for de som var på den siden som forsvarte systemet. Sant? De ble mer klare over den eksponeringen, og begynte I større grad å sikre de systemene.
Ved hjelp av å søke I Shodan fant vi også over 2500 styringssystemer. Instrumentpanel som potensielt kan styre all slags maskiner og utstyr.
Styringssystemer, generelt IT-systemer I prinsippet som brukes til å styre alle mulige prosesser fra oljeutvinning til strømforsyning, til å styre busser, missiler, jagerfly, skip. Det brukes stort sett overalt I samfunnet, det slags nervesystem I samfunnet.
Shodan has been a game changer in a few ways because it now provides actual data. So you can tell people this is a real threat. Before, people had always speculated that these big systems like power plants were online, but they never found them. They never were sure that they actually existed. Now Shodan provides actual, real data.
Forsker Iren Leverett ved det internasjonale datasikkerhetsselskapet IoActive har selv testet sikkerheten rundt styringssystemer internasjonalt.
I think most everyday people would expect the level of security of these devices to be much, much higher. They would expect that they are rigorously tested and use strong cryptography and are protected by a firewall. And I think most people would be very shocked to see the state that some of these systems are in. And how poorly protected they can be at certain times.
Shodan-konstruktøren ser en helt ny trend komme, nemlig hacking av forbrukerteknologi og frykter tallenes makt.
The danger of numbers is a problem where even though it's possible to compromise, you know, one webcam or one router, nobody cares about. But if you're able to compromise 100,000 or a million within a country, then all of a sudden you have a national security problem. So the problem with numbers is one device, nobody cares. A million, national security problem.
You can find a lot of them very, very fast. And a lot of them run the same types of software. And so if you can find a vulnerability in that software, you can affect many devices at once, and not one.
John Matherly mener han selv I det godes tjeneste, og ønsker at søkemotoren hans skal brukes I sikkerhetsøyemed. Han lar blant annet institusjoner og skoler få teste sine IP-adresser gratis.
I'm not doing anything for the bad guys. I'm providing a tool and a research utility for the good guys.
So if you go into null control at dagbladet.no, you will find lots and lots of stories about these different exposed systems in Norway. And I'm not going to show this video, but it's kind of it's a video where one of the system owners, it's a small company called Lofotnet, where they had some FTP service available online that they weren't aware of. Files in there were describing there were files with lists of all their customers, and also their usernames and passwords could be found in some of these files in clear text. So it's kind of bad practice. And when this was found by the reporters and they told this story, Lofotnet actually went bankrupt. So this is the business owner in the moment he's getting this information and is realizing that, okay, this probably means the end of my business. And that was correct. Couldn't continue doing business after this exposure. So small businesses can easily go bankrupt if they make mistakes like this. Larger businesses usually can get through cyber incident unless it sort of damages the product that you are actually selling so that you cannot sell it anymore. There's one example that I like to cite when it comes to businesses going out of business because of cyber attacks, and that is the DG Notar case. I don't know if you remember it, it's from like four years ago. DG Notar is one of the companies that issued server certificates that are installed in every browser, which means that you can surf the web and you can have some kind of security when you see the HTTPS. And you get the green bar and maybe get the padlock and things. It's all based on the fact that we are trusting server certificate or website certificate issuers. And DigiNotar was one of these issuers and they got hacked, which meant that it was possible for hacker to issue false certificates, which happened. So there were lots of false certificates, and this was discovered because of a false Google certificate, which was discovered by a user in Iran when he tried to log on to his Gmail account. He got this weird error message that he reported, and this sort of started the whole thing. And it was found out that someone was had been able to intrude into DigiNotar's networks and get false certificates issued that potentially could decrypt all the encrypted web communication. And because of this, DigiNotar, as a company, went bankrupt. They were first seized by the Dutch government. They were a Dutch company. And then, after a while, they were out of business. So there are some examples of companies being really damaged by cyber attacks. There are also examples where you think they would be damaged, but then you see the stock price is increasing after, or you get more users after a breach, like for instance with LinkedIn and others. If you're interested in looking at more closely at the world's biggest data breaches, so these are sorted by number of records compromised. There's a really beautiful infographics that I would encourage you to look into. It's called info. Oh, you can't really see it there, but the information is beautiful. I have put the slides up on Frontier, so you can download the slides and get the, and click on the links. Here you can also click on each of the different incidents and get more details about them. But there are lots of things to learn from looking into how companies are breached. But sometimes you can, with very small resources, make a lot of money and influence opinions, which is harder to put a value on. I don't know if you have seen this before, but in this case, someone managed to get into the Twitter account of Associated Press. So what they did was to issue a false news tweet saying that there was something going on in at the White House and Barack Obama is injured. So really big news, of course, false news. But what happened in this case is that this had a huge impact on the Dow Jones Stock Exchange. So because of this news, this false news that was tweeted, there was a panic among the stock traders. So someone could actually do this to make a lot of money by affecting, by buying stocks and affecting the stock price by spreading false news. Or as we have seen lately, you can use cyber activity to spread misinformation and potentially hack an election by this type of campaign. So during the last few weeks, we got a lot of information that was declassified by the US government about their investigations into Russian alleged Russian hacking that was meant to influence the elections going on in the US. So this is an example of information sharing report that is usually not TLP white. And one of you know what TLP means, by the way? No? Yeah, one person. TLP, traffic light protocol. We're going to come back to that later in this in the series of lectures when I come to incident response. But it's a way of telling, or it's a way of keeping track of how information is shared. So when it's TLP white, means you can share it with everyone. But then you have the traffic lights are yellow, no, green, yellow, red. So white isn't even a traffic light, at least not in Norway. So white is totally free to share. If you have green, you can share it, but only between sort of the InfoSec community. Amber or yellow, you can only share between within your organization or your contractors and customers. There's actually two definitions of yellow. One you cannot share with the customers, and one you can share with the customers. And then red you cannot share with anyone. So, and then you have classification, which is which is used by the intelligence community and military, which is according to the security laws, where there are strict rules for sharing different types of information. But in this case, this is typical information that usually is not shared with everyone, but the US CERT, US government CERT, which is part of the MKIC and Homeland Security, they decided to share this with everyone. So if you read this report, it's not the best report, I would say. It seems like they had to redact a lot of information, so you cannot get all the context, which is bad. And then, but they have a very good example of how threat intelligence information looks like, and how the defenders usually share, what type of information the defenders share amongst themselves. Now, what's interesting in this report is they call it the Grizzly Steppe, and it's describing the way that two cyber espionage group, which goes under different names, usually operating. One is called, in this report, APT-28, and the other APT-29, but they go under different names. So now I come into something called attribution, which is a kind of dangerous minefield area, I would say. So everyone is analyzing malware and malware campaigns and in some cases try to figure out who is behind, who is doing the hacking. Can we identify a person or maybe a nation or a sort of unit within that nation who's behind the attack? And in this case, they claim it's from Russia and other also non-government agencies like antivirus companies and security companies have investigated the same incidents and named them different things, but they are sort of referring to the same group. So APT-28 is also known as Fancy Bear. CrowdStrike is a security company that likes that have their own system for naming threat actors. So if they name it something with bear, it's they claim it's from Russia. If they name it something with panda, they claim it's the Chinese, and so on. So they call it Fancy Bear, but it's also been called the Sufasi group. Pawnstorm, and so on. And then they had the other group, APT-28, is called Cozy Bear by CrowdStrike. It's called, so F-Secure has been looking into this group for a long while, and they called them the Dukes, or the Mini Duke, Cozy Duke, and a lot of things with Duke in the name. So if you read F-Secure's report, that they are sort of referring to the same thing, but call it something Duke. Sorry about confusing you about all these names, but that's how this looks like if you're trying to make sense of all the different reports. But what's interesting is that this Cozy Bear group has been connected to the hacking of the Democratic National Committee, and sort of being blamed for being part of this influence campaign to the US elections, and also the Cozy Bear has been connected to the same thing. And I would actually recommend, if you're interested, to read this report, which came out last week, which is a declassified report from the U.S. intelligence services about how they look at this election campaign influence thing. And this gives more kind of context and background than the U.S. search report. But if you want to have look at an example of how information sharing reports can typically look like between defenders, it's the U.S. search report, which has some indicators of compromise, or IOCs, which they call it, and lists what type of IP addresses you should be aware of, and so on. But this report has been, as I said, kind of criticized in the community, because the list of IP addresses was not very well cleaned. Some of them are obvious false positives. So it's not a good idea for a defender to take all these IP addresses into their intrusion detection system, for instance, so with a lot of false alarms, which is a problem. Okay, so moving into Norwegian incidents. Of course, we should be aware of this influence campaigns, because we have elections coming up in Europe too, in Norway and many other countries. But this is the first time that we got a public incident that was discussed in the media about the attacks against Norwegian infrastructure. So this happened in 2014 while I was working at NorthCert, so I have some insights into the incident handling of this these attacks. So the headline said, "Hundreds of Norwegian energy companies hit by cyber attacks." What it actually was a lot of spear phishing campaigns targeted against Norwegian companies. But it wasn't targeted specifically against Norwegian companies, it was targeted against companies in lots of different countries. But of course, the Norwegian press will focus on the Norwegian side of this. So kind of unusual thing was that the NSM and NorthCert decided to make a lot of this information public to create an awareness campaign in the energy sector, because we want to protect national critical infrastructure from cyber attacks in the future. And this seemed like it could be a campaign doing reconnaissance and figuring out what type of industrial control systems different Norwegian companies were running. It was a campaign described by others as Energetic Bear, also called Havex by F-Secure. They were focusing on looking at the particular malware that was being used in the campaign, that was identified as Havex. Kaspersky Labs also looked into this, and they called it Crouching Yeti, because they don't like to use the same names as everyone else. Okay. Anyway, it was part of this was a spear phishing campaign. It means highly targeted emails going to select people that were working in the energy business, and it had malicious attachments. It was one of the vectors that was being used. So here you can see a conference invitation that was sent as part of this campaign. And it was sent to researchers and people that were actually kind of potential receivers of these types of emails. When we looked into this, we didn't figure out the exact place where the attackers could have found the list of people that they sent the emails to. But we suspected that they might have taken a list of participants to conference and use that for their spear phishing campaign to make it more likely that they opened the attachment. This is one example, and there's a conference program doc file, and this actually used social engineering by making I think this used a macro enabling thing to install malware, and the malware that was inside the attachment was identified as Havex, and Havex was a kind of complex malware. Some of our analysts looked more closely into it, and we could see that it had the potential to download several new modules of malware from the internet, and one of the modules contained a component that was looking for a specific type of file or specific type of system on the network that was usually used in control systems, and could, if infected, be used to shut down processes and operations. So that was pretty nasty. Another name for this campaign was Dragonfly, by the way. And one of the other attack vectors that was used was malicious software downloads. So it's not only spear phishing emails. So what they typically did in this case was to find contractors of the targets that they were interested in, or suppliers to the targets. So someone that is making components that are of interest to the attacker. And in this case, this is a supplier of a VPN, remote access solution, that is used in a lot of industrial control systems. And they found some vulnerabilities in their websites, and they were actually managed to replace the software downloads with software downloads that had incorporated the Havex malware. So when you're an engineer and you need to update or patch the system, you typically go to this website, you download the software installation file, put it in a memory stick, plug it into the control system, and there you have a file also containing the malware. And the third attack vector that they also used in the same campaign was something called watering hole attacks. Anyone know what that is? Heard about watering holes? Okay, I'm going to explain it. So watering holes, it's instead of sending like attachment and emails and going out to the victim, you just find a place where the victim will likely go, and you just comfortably wait there for them to come to you. It's just kind of easier way. So for instance, lion waiting at the watering hole for the zebras to come. So what an attacker does is to do some reconnaissance first, figure out what's your target's interests, what kind of websites will they likely surf into, and then you find some vulnerabilities on these sites, search for vulnerabilities, and then you inject your malware or exploit into these interesting sites. And often then they can contain whitelists. So if you're only interested in certain types of victims, or you have a list of victims that you're interested in, you can whitelist everyone else. So it's only if the victim is coming from certain IP addresses that they get served the malware. Or they get in other cases, if you don't give them malware, you can just have some malicious scripts running that are doing reconnaissance on their systems. So they can, for instance, figure out what type of web browser you're using, version of the Java that's installed, Flash or whatever, and so on. And this can then be used to launch further attacks. You can use a zero-day exploit if you are well-resourced adversary. So that's what we saw in this campaign targeting what seems to be the energy sector of Norway, with these three different ways of infecting the victims. In this case, the malware didn't have any sabotage or destructive component, but it could be, perhaps, it's only speculation from my side, but it could have been a reconnaissance attack to gain information about what types of systems were out there to later be used in a more offensive operation. So we don't have a lot of well-documented cases of sabotage and destructive malware. When this report came out, it was the actual second time that the malware had caused physical damage, and it was a malware that spread in a German steel mill, and it came in via the office network as a spear phishing phishing email. Someone clicked, got malware in the system, and this malware then enabled a cyber attack on the production facilities, leading to a meltdown of their ovens and actual physical damage because of the malware. But since this, we have had two more. So the first one, I forgot to mention it, but this is of course Stuxnet. Everyone's heard about Stuxnet, I assume. Who has heard about Stuxnet? Okay, so I'm not going to bore you with the whole Stuxnet thing. But if you want to look more into details of Stuxnet, I recommend highly this analysis, technical analysis of the Stuxnet campaign. Really interesting to read. It's an example of how someone with lots of resources can do lots of damage. But then we have the Ukrainian power grid. Actual two incidents so far. One is very well documented. This one from not last year, but the year before that, because a lot of reports came out last year. And then we had one recently, just before Christmas, that hasn't really had any detailed reports yet. It's just some researchers have said that it's also a cyber attack. It wasn't caused by natural causes. But the first incident that caused a blackout in Ukraine was also an example of how you can penetrate into process control systems, going through the office network. So the first thing that happened was that someone clicked on an email attachment, opened up a Word document, and here it is, asking in Ukrainian to enable macros, and then malware got installed. So the malware was called Black Energy, and Black Energy worked in a way that it harvested credentials. So once you had this in network, it would start cracking your passwords, doing credential harvesting. Then the attackers got hold of these credentials, and they logged in via remote access solutions, like VPN solutions, to the control systems. And they also, the more advanced component of this was that they also figure out all the components of their network, and they tailored a firmware exploit for some RTUs that were used to control different parts of the grid, and they installed this malicious firmware on this RTUs, components that can switch on and off parts of the grid. And then they orchestrated the attack by logging into the systems through the remote access solutions, and actually just performing legitimate actions on the operator's screen. So they The operators could see ghost mouse clicking on things on their HMI human machine interface screen, and it was just switching off parts of the grid, shutting down things, opening breakers, and then the malicious firmware made it impossible to switch them back on again afterwards, which made the blackout last some hours. So that's from a report that I also highly recommend that you read if you're interested in this, from the SANS ICS site. So yeah, that's it for our first 2 hours, and we start again in 1 hour at K105. So hope to see you all there. And then we'll get more interaction, I promise. I'm not going to talk all the time. So have a good lunch.